This evening, I'm sorry, yes, this evening, 6 to 7:30 at Peninsula Park, North Ainsworth and Albina. Be there. September 13th coming up next week is this landmark case. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned for Linda Olson Osterlund. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Capitalism must die and leave the Arctic sound. Die, capitalism must die.
And it does fertilize
power that is local community size. Sustainability
and an end to this insanity
and an answer to the question to be.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Institute for Anarchist Studies 20th Anniversary Celebration on Friday, September 9th at Audio Cinema in Portland. The Institute for Anarchist Studies is an organization that gives grants to radical writers, publishes the journal Perspectives on Anarchist Theory, and engages in educational activities. This event features Portland DJs Katie Pants and Nathan Carson, and a performance by Mike Crenshaw. Again, that's the Institute for Anarchist Studies 20th Anniversary Celebration, Friday, September 9th, starting at 8 p.m. at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Join KBOO Community Radio at Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, September the 8th for United We Stand Up, a comedy show and a benefit for KBOO. I'm T6, and I'll be your host that night, which will feature local comedians like Betty Lungen, Bree Pruitt, Adam Potsey, Brandy Morgan, Belinda Giles, Noriko Ott, and Debbie Wooten. Raffles, refreshments, and good times for all. Again, that's United We Stand Up, Thursday, September the 8th, at Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. Doors at 6:30, showcase at 7:30. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. Right away, it's Political Perspectives. Host Linda Olson Osterlund interviews Rachel Maripol, attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. They'll talk about the recent reinstatement of their lawsuit against the Bureau of Prisons for the assignment of prisoners to secretive units called CMUs. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And then at 10:15, Flashpoints looks to Brazil, where there have been massive protests against what's being called a parliamentary coup, and the police have launched brutal attacks on protesters. Also featured is an intimate interview with Portlander S. Brian Wilson about the new documentary film about him that we all know about. At 11 o'clock, The Bike Show speaks with two local bike adventurists, Jasmine Reese and Spencer Harding, about what they did this summer. And we thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. We hope everybody out there listening is a member. If you're not, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and then click on Donate.
Okay, good morning. And thank you for tuning in to KBOO and Political Perspectives this morning. I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund, your host, and we're going to be talking about a federal prisoner lawsuit that was a lawsuit by federal prisoners that was brought against the government for secretive units known as CMUs, Communication Management Units. I want to let you know right now, this is going to be call-in after the first half hour, so at 9:30, and you can, you know, get on hold a few minutes before that if you want to and you really have something you'd like to say or ask questions for. The number will be our regular number for call-ins. It's 503-231-8187. That won't start for another half hour because I want to talk with our expert for a while and give us a little background before we get into your comments and your questions, but I definitely want to hear from you as well. So the subject, as I said, was this lawsuit on behalf of prisoners in federal prisons against communication management units and specifically how people are assigned to them. And our guest is staff attorney, Ms. Maripol, and she has been a staff attorney and also director of education for the Center for Constitutional Rights. And if you're not familiar with that, we call it CCR. The Center for Constitutional Right fight is a nonprofit that fights on behalf of everyone that the government is trying to take down, basically. They fight on those who need serve, especially First Amendment rights, constitutional rights that are being violated. Rachel Maripol, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be on the show.
I was really happy to have you. I know in your history you were also, you still are, attorney on the Pelican Bay solitary confinement case, which is a very important one. And you have another case that we'll be talking about that may be brought up by the Supreme Court dealing with the mass incarceration of Muslims and others immediately following 9/11, locked with no real charges for months. So we'll get to those, but let's talk about CMUs. And I'd like it if you could start just telling us what it is and when did they first start?
Sure. So CMUs, or Communication Management Units, are segregated prison units within a larger prison. So the Federal Bureau of Prisons has created two of these units so far. The first one appeared in 2006, and the second one popped up a few years later. The first unit was opened in Terre Haute, Indiana, and the second one in Marion, Illinois. So these are units where the Bureau of Prisons places prisoners whose communication with the outside world it wants to restrict. Prisoners placed in CMUs have very, very limited communication with the outside world. So they have absolutely no opportunity for contact visitation. Any visitation happens, over the telephone, through glass. They have much less access to telephone communication than other federal prisoners. All of their communications with the outside world are monitored and analyzed by counterterrorism unit officials in the Bureau of Prisons. They're segregated sort of within a unit to themselves. So the two units can hold between 30 to 60 men each, and prisoners placed in these units are completely isolated from the rest of the prison population, no interaction with sort of the general population of the prison. They're not placed in solitary confinement, so it's different than solitary confinement. They are not kept in their cells 24 hours a day. They can move about their small unit with some freedom. But they are only able to interact with those same other few men who are isolated with them, really limiting their ability to sort of have any kind of normal incarceration experience.
Is there reading material also more restricted?
Yes. Prisoners who try to get information sent to them from the outside world, all mail coming into and out of the unit is monitored and analyzed by counterterrorism unit officials before it is approved. And that monitoring means that much more mail is rejected than it usually occurs in a general prison population setting, especially because the people who sort of are in this unit tend to be outspoken prisoners, right? First of all, the most defining thing about the population of people in CMUs so far is that it's predominantly Muslim. So the Bureau of Prisons overall has about a 6% population of Muslims within the prison system. The CMUs are over 60% Muslim. It's a huge overrepresentation, right? And the individuals placed in these units tend to come from sort of the leadership of the Muslim community in prison. So people who are sort of, you know, speaking out, leading religious discussions within prison, advocating for more religious freedom within prison for themselves and others of their faith. We also see a lot of jailhouse lawyers being placed in CMUs, so individuals who are advocating for themselves or for others to try to get better treatment inside. We see prisoners who were involved with various political movements before they went to prison.
Environmental activists have been sent there in larger than normal numbers, is that correct?
That is correct. That's right. One of our clients, Daniel McGowan, was an environmental activist before he was sent to prison. And so he's a good example of sort of the limitation of information from the outside coming into these units. He continued to correspond with sort of law-abiding social justice activists while he was in prison, and they would send him a lot of material, you know, magazine, newspaper articles, books, that sort of thing. And he found that when he was in a CMU, as compared to when he was in a general prison population unit, so much of his mail was rejected. And, you know, any time he tried to get information about sort of even mainstream sort of environmental issues, a lot of that was rejected by the Bureau of Prisons.
You know, Rachel, can we go back to the formation of these? Were these formed in any public process? Was there, I know there wasn't, you know, there wasn't a legislative manner. And what was the supposed justification for creating, I mean, that must have cost some money to develop these things. And so what was the alleged or the outspoken purpose, and what's the stated purpose now for this type of unit?
Right. Very good questions. So, you know, initially the idea for this kind of prison unit was floated by the Bush administration back in, I believe, 2004. So the idea was, at that point, it was called a counterterrorism or a terrorist unit, I believe, is what it was phrased then. And the Bush administration actually proposed the creation of these units using the federal rulemaking process. So proposed this as a new rule for the Bureau of Prisons and solicited comments from the public. You know, that's what happens anytime there's going to be a major change into how the mm-hmm. Bureau of Prisons operates, of course, because they're subject to federal regulation. So there was a lot of outcry among the sort of prisoners, advocates, population when these units were proposed. People saying, you know, this is unnecessary, it's a violation of due process. Putting particular prisoners in these units would violate their First Amendment rights, their due process rights. It would be cruel because of, you know, the type of communications restrictions that were contemplated at that time. So the Bush administration actually withdrew the proposed rule, and then the units just popped up without any public disclosure a couple years later under the new name, Communication Management Unit, without going through the required public notice and comment procedure that is required by the Administrative Procedures Act. So that was actually one of the issues that we initially challenged when the Center for Constitutional Rights brought this lawsuit back in 2010, is when we first filed, is the fact that the units themselves at that point were operating illegally. There was no federal regulation that allowed the Bureau of Prisons to create these new units or put prisoners in there. And in fact, nobody would have even known that the units existed, except that, you know, when the first 20 or so prisoners were sent there, they began reaching out to lawyers and the media saying, I've been placed in this bizarre unit. I don't know what it's about. You know, do you have any information about it? And at that time, if someone had done a communication management unit Google search or something like that, you would have found absolutely no information about what was going on. It was just done with complete secrecy.
Like so many things that the government was doing and has been doing in that time, the formation of fusion centers, then they go back and they try to create statutes or not really laws. They don't go through the legislature, but they create ways of which they justify it. Have you seen any written information from them that says who would be placed in these units and for what reasons?
Yes. Well, so in, I believe, 2015, so this would have been 9 years after the first unit was opened, the Bureau of Prisons finally issued a final rule creating the units, post facto creating a legal framework for these units. And so there now is an official rule about, you know, what the units are for and who should be put in there. And there's criteria laid out explaining who's eligible for placement in one of these units. So that includes individuals who've been convicted of a crime related to terrorism, individuals who have repeatedly violated communications-related rules in a prison setting, individuals who continue to attempt to try to contact the victims of their crime, or sort of anyone else, basically, who the Bureau of Prisons thinks their communications require more robust monitoring than in general. You know, what's kind of amazing about these criteria is, you know, not only how broad they are, it could apply to thousands of individuals within the Bureau of Prisons, but also the fact that they were sort of created after the fact. Now, we learned in the discovery process in our lawsuit that when the CMUs were first opened, there was absolutely no criteria at all to determine who should be placed there. And the Bureau of Prisons actually developed the criteria based on the type of people it found it was sending to the unit, right? So at a certain point, you know, there started to be a few prisoners who had reached out and tried to contact their victims repeatedly, right? Mm-hmm. Those are people who, understandably, the Bureau of Prisons wants to monitor their communications. And so it sent a few of those people to the unit and it said, hey, maybe we should make this a criteria. Okay, here, let's make this a criteria, which, of course, is just, you know, completely backwards. And it creates a real dilemma for all the men who were sent to this unit, you know, during that long period before there was any criteria. They, of course, had no way to say, I don't belong here, you can't send me here, because they had no way to know who did belong there. You know,
they had no procedures. I read some of the information that they would be sent, they would just be moved one day, and they wouldn't be told why or for what reasons or what infraction they had done, something like that. By the way, let me tell the audience again that I'm speaking with Rachel Maripol, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and we're talking about a lawsuit that's gotten reinstated, a lawsuit that she's helped bring reinstated, to develop real criteria for placement in federal prisons, CMUs, communication management units. You know, I wanted to bring up, Rachel, that I had done an interview with a woman named Victoria Brittain, or Britain, I guess is the way you say it. Actually, I always want to pronounce it wrong because it's got two T's, but it's Victoria Brittain, and she is an author and journalist in the UK, and she wrote a book called Shadow Lives, The Forgotten Women of the War on Terror. And most of the women that she talks to and interviews and tells us their stories, their husbands or sons or brothers were locked in prison in the UK, which has its own set of special restrictions for prisoners they designate as terrorists. One of them, though, and actually three of the families you can find in this book, were locked in CMUs, one of them in Marion. And what I wanted to bring up about this is this book, why this author wrote this book, and I did link to it on the website under this show's name and schedule for today, so you can go to it there at kboo.fm. But she wanted to show that it's not just the prisoner that's so harmed by this kind of communication restriction, but that their families, their children who don't get to see their dad, when it's no contact, you can't even touch your dad. You can't reach through the plexiglass and have any kind of physical contact, which is, actually, I think, very harmful to humans. We need, I mean, I think it's scientifically been proven that we need that kind of physical contact with each other. And so I wanted to bring that issue up. Can you talk a little bit about some of the prisoners you've worked on behalf and what this has meant for them and their families being in these units?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the stories from my clients whose young children have visited them in the CMUs are really the most heartbreaking. You have to understand, you know, in the media, I feel like, you know, in pop culture, when a movie or a television show depicts prison visitation, it is generally through glass, right? That's kind of this idea of that the general
right.
public thinks of when we think about visitation.
But and they reach for
really,
the phone.
Right, exactly. That's not how visitation in the prison system largely works. You know, normally individuals are able to sit at a table with their loved one, hug them briefly at the beginning of a visit, and then at the end of a visit, you know, sit and talk and eat some vending machine food together and play cards, you know, do sort of normal things. And that is hugely important for prisoners maintaining their sort of family ties, especially with young children. So you contrast that experience with, you know, trying to bring a four-year-old into a small telephone booth, basically, to communicate with their father over the phone. That kid is going to have absolutely no idea why they can't, you know, hug their dad or go sit on his lap. And it's incredibly damaging, not only for, you know, the child, who I think, you know, is going to have a very difficult time maintaining any sort of meaningful relationship with their loved one in that context. But, you know, a lot of the men who I've talked to say, you know, the visits were so painful and just, you know, so overwhelming that it just started to feel like it wasn't worth having those visits at all, you know, that it was just too difficult for them, too difficult for their children, such that they, you know, they questioned whether it was worth the family even making the trip. And that's really why we have been struggling for, you know, over 6 years now to try to put in place just some procedural protections to limit, you know, who is placed in this unit and for how long. Now, when the units were first opened, there was just absolutely no process in place to get people out, right? So the men who were being placed in these units, some of whom, you know, like several of my clients, had material support for terrorism convictions, where they were facing, you know, long periods of time in federal prison, decades in federal prison. They had, you know, they went in with the sense that they were going to be in these units for the rest of their prison sentence, which might mean that they weren't able to hug their child for that kid's whole childhood, right? That they would grow up never being able to have that physical contact.
And I want to bring up at this point that many of the people, Muslims, that were arrested on terrorist charges were arrested as a result of stings that many people feel were inappropriately used, that it was the federal government providing all of the money, the resources, and even the ideology behind it to carry out an action that I don't believe almost any of them in prison have actually carried out a terrorist action other than what's been called support for, you know, material support, but the actual having done something like taken a bomb or, you know, haven't. And so we want to remember that these people were not, this isn't that big scary guy out there that wants to blow up your kid's marathon.
That's absolutely right. And Yasin Arif, who, you know, the case is named for, is a prime example there. You know, he was called in to witness a loan, to witness a transaction, a monetary transaction between an FBI informant, you know, and another individual from his community. The FBI created this whole, you know, fake terrorist attack with fake terrorists and everything. And all my client did was sort of witness a monetary transaction that, you know, he really didn't know what it was about or what was going on. And for that, he was placed, you know, he was convicted of material support, placed in prison, and with four young children who, you know, for years on end were completely unable to, visit him in any sort of meaningful or helpful way. And of course, the fact that telephone communication is so limited as well is extremely problematic. You know, the telephone is the most important way that prisoners can communicate with the outside world, especially in the federal prison system, where frequently prisoners are going to be moved to a prison, you know, out of state, so far from their loved ones, making visitation very expensive and very difficult, even if it isn't a, you know, terrible experience across glass. But telephone communication is very limited in the CMUs. When the CMUs first opened, prisoners were only given one 15-minute telephone call a week. So, you know, say you have parents, you have a wife, you have children. Who do you spend that 15 minutes on?
Yeah, who do you decide?
And can you have any real conversation with any of them in that short a period of time? So it's just it's a devastating sort of situation for prisoners and for their family members. And despite the real impact of being placed in one of these units, maybe for one's entire prison sentence, the Bureau of Prisons has insisted that prisoners have absolutely no right to any procedural protections before being placed in this type of unit.
And that does bring us back to the specifics of this case. Why don't you talk about the specifics of this case?
Sure. So we filed a RAF v. Lynch back in 2010. And the prime claim in the case, you know, there's several legal claims we've made, but really the most important claim is challenging the fact that prisoners are sent to these units without notice, without any opportunity to learn of the true reason they're being sent to the CMU, or to argue that reason is erroneous, you know, either based on bad facts or doesn't fit sort of any real criteria, and that they're not given adequate periodic review of their placement. So they're not told what they need to do to earn their way out of the unit or when they might get out of the unit. And when we first brought the lawsuit, there was just absolutely no procedure in place for a prisoner to say, you know, the reason you've put me in this unit is wrong, right? So,
and actually, there's not been any communication violations from those prisoners as well.
That's right.
Nothing to justify it. It's not that they've, before or after being placed, there had committed violations around communications.
That's right. I mean, violating communication rules is one criteria the BOP now says it might use. But for our clients, they were simply picked up from, you know, the general prison population where they had been serving their time without issue and placed in one of these units with no warning at all. Prisoners, after they're placed in a CMU, get a one-page notice of transfer. And that notice of transfer says a few sentences about the purported reason why the prisoner is being sent to a CMU. But what we were able to learn through the lawsuit is that even that reason, which on its face is not adequate, but even that is not actually the real reason why a prisoner is sent to a CMU. So the information that a prisoner is given after he's been sent to the unit is the reason why the counterterrorism unit of the Bureau of Prisons has recommended the prisoner for placement in a CMU. But the counterterrorism unit isn't the one who actually makes the decision to send a prisoner to the CMU. That's a different Bureau of Prisons bureaucrat. And that bureaucrat could base his decision on what the counterterrorism unit recommends or something else entirely. And he doesn't write the reason for his decision down anywhere, and he never tells the prisoner what it is. So there's just no way to know
what the real reason was. Yeah, it makes it completely secret. It does remind you of Guantanamo and how as every challenge comes forward, they have to come up with new ways to say, no, we have a process here that's fair. And yet it never really is. I understand that among some attorneys, the prisons in Marion have been called Gitmo North.
That's right. And I think a lot of that really came from the prisoners themselves sort of looking around the unit and seeing that it is this predominantly Muslim unit, which is a very different experience, of course, than what the population looks like in the prisons overall.
And on the face of it, looks like discrimination.
Yeah, it's that religious profiling that I think it is an aspect of the units that is so upsetting to the prisoners, this sense that you know, they have been singled out for special treatment because of their religious views and because of their faith. And that is an important part of this story, really. It's not that, you know, the Bureau of Prisons is not imposing CMU placement across the board in any sort of fair way. And, of course, that's always going to happen if there aren't procedural protections.
Well, you know, and developing a whole new category like this should involve that at the beginning and should involve review. I think that, you know, I've noticed over the years that the terrorism, you know, you could add terrorism to another charge, and that makes that charge far more serious. And so, for example, if someone shot someone for a terrorist reason or broke into a place for a terrorist reason, you can add it. I believe it adds 20 years to the sentence, or can.
Right.
These CMUs don't appear to be filled with white supremacists who have carried out terrorist actions or anti-abortionists who have carried out terrorist actions against clinics. So we see where the prejudice about what is terrorism and what is not, way back from there, is the starting point. This wasn't a unit planned to protect us from all terrorists. Or they would be charging terrorism for people who do acts that are clearly part of that definition. So do you know if there are any like white supremacist terrorists locked up in the CMUs?
Well, the unit is constant. The population of the unit is constantly in flux these days, and it's secret. So it's hard for anyone to say exactly who's there. And that's really how the Bureau of Prisons wants it, right? So they have created this situation. They've tried to create this situation where, without any procedural oversight or review by the federal courts, they can put whomever they want in this unit without ever having to justify it. And what's so amazing about where we are in the case right now is that finally, after, you know, over a decade of challenging these units, the federal court has finally said, no, you know, excuse me, these units are so serious. The conditions there are so onerous, and who's being placed there is so suspicious that prisoners do have a liberty interest in avoiding placement in this type of unit, and you need to provide them due process before you move them in there.
And so your lawsuit gets to go forward. What is the next step with it?
Well, we wait for a little while to see what the government wants to do. Excuse me. They could ask the circuit court to rehear the case or to rehear it en banc, which means all the judges on the D.C. Circuit would hear the case instead of leaving it as it is now, decided by a 3-judge appellate panel. It's a rather unusual procedural step, but it sometimes happens. The government could seek review by the Supreme Court. They have some time to ask the Supreme Court to take the case. But those are unusual sort of procedural things that don't happen in the vast majority of cases. What's most likely going to happen next is that the case will be remanded back to the district court judge. And at this point, the district court judge will now have the opportunity to review all the evidence that we presented to her several years ago, showing just how broken all the procedures are that the BOP uses to place prisoners in a CMU and to review them. So, you know, over the years, the Bureau of Prisons has created sort of a patina of process. You know, it's sort of there are these procedures, these hoops that prisoners have to jump through that, you know, look nice on paper, but when you look at what actually happens, they're completely meaningless. It's like I was saying earlier about a prisoner being provided notice of a reason why he was put in the CMU, but it's not the actual reason, right? So we would finally get a judge, you know, now to look at this and say, is this adequate? Is this due process?
Yeah, is the prisoner receiving due process under the Constitution?
That's right.
Rachel, I want to open our phone lines. We have a good progressive audience out there that's very intelligent and tuned in, and I'd like them to call in with their questions and their comments. So our phone number is 503-231-8187. Let me say it again, 503-231-8187. Call with your comments, call call with your questions. Rachel has also been the attorney on the Pelican Bay solitary confinement case, which was a big one. We covered here a lot, and I think many of you are interested in, so you can call and ask about that as well. Rachel, it seems to me that until the issue of discrimination can be honestly addressed, and I don't know how that can be in the system, because it seems like these units were created and they're functioning as a new type of unit in a way that, you know, has stayed out of official oversight for so long. And I really appreciate the work that you at Center for Constitutional Rights do for this. Talk about this. Are we ever going to get a definition of terrorism that includes everybody who intends to terrorize others with use of force or violence or coercion? We don't have that in this country, clearly. What do you think will be the future of this?
Right. It's such a difficult question. And I think the way that, you know, sort of the terrorism label functions now is so problematic. We actually, at the Center for Constitutional Rights, also represent individuals who've been convicted of animal enterprise terrorism under the Animal Enterprise Terrorist Act, which is this federal law that basically nobody knows about, which makes it a federal crime of terrorism to damage the property of an animal enterprise. And that's really any business that uses or sells animal products. And because property includes intangible property in general under federal law, it's actually under the law a federal crime to cause a business which uses or sells animal products to lose money or to lose profit, right? And these are the kind of terrorists who can now be placed in communication management units once they're in the Federal Bureau of Prisons.
You know, Rachel, I recently saw that some films from inside a Tyson chicken growing came to light, and actually charges were brought against Tyson for the way that the chickens were handled. And I was so surprised that the people who got in and did those photographs weren't charged under this act or have
right.
not
and,
been
and
yet.
Certainly people who do that kind of undercover investigation or whistleblowing face really serious legal repercussions because of their activism and their bravery. And so, you know, we see, as you were saying, I think the word terrorism completely divorced from what, you know, the general public might think that word means. And instead of, you know, prison officials making decisions about how prisoners are treated based on their actual behavior in prison and the threat they might pose to the rest of the prison population or to the outside community, classification in prison is being done based on ideology or religious faith. You know,
yeah,
that
it seems very
Muslims
clearly
are
it
dangerous,
is.
Right? Muslims are dangerous in prison, so we have to put them in these restrictive units. And, you know, activists are dangerous in prison, so we put them in these restrictive units. And this is a political prison within a prison.
Yes.
Something that I think, you know, we would generally reject as a population if everyone really understood that it was happening.
Well, and if we heard about it in another country, we'd say, oh, how horrible that that country does that. I believe we have a caller on the line. Christian's on the line.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. Thanks for calling. What would you like to say?
Awesome. I just have a little contribution to pretty much what prisons and what they should do for humanity, and what is the main purpose for prison to help the human being to correct any kind of mistake that they have done in their lives. And I can tell that Rachel is mentioning a lot of moral constitutional rights is more individual rights also that these people have been, you know, being evaded and are being invited actually. And it's not making any sense. It's what is causing all these conflicts in between. And my question mainly is, okay, these CMU units, what are they really doing for the prisoner? Like, are these CMU units just like the same as normal prison, and they're just taking away advantages for them, or like communication advantages mainly, and is it just, do they have a specific program that they are taking that person with those charges and are pretty much saying, okay, we're going to work with you through this, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, like, are they actually trying to rehabilitate them or give them information
or
skills?
Or if it's or if it's profiling and if it's by ideologies and political, you know, attacks, then are they just locking these people out in the CMUs, completely isolate them and not let them, you know, have anything, not really working with them?
Rachel, why don't you go ahead and talk?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it's the CMUs are really about isolating prisoners from the outside world and the rest of the prison population to sort of contain what the Bureau of Prisons thinks are their dangerous ideas or their dangerous ideology. There's very little rehabilitative programming within the units. The Bureau of Prisons provides programming, of course, to all of its prisoners as a matter of course and as a matter of policy. And so it does, you know, on paper, give some of those opportunities to CMU prisoners. But if you look beyond the paper, you'll see that the opportunities are very limited. So, for example, in a general prison setting, prisoners usually have access to classes or work assignments to keep them busy during the day, to gain skills, to earn money. In the CMU, all the classes available to prisoners are prisoner-taught classes. So the population in the CMU is actually quite educated and sophisticated, and so that's wonderful in some ways, but, you know, the prisoners only have the ability to sort of attend classes taught by other prisoners depending on what sort of the people they're locked up with might, you know, have knowledge of. They have no access to the kind of more general educational opportunities that the rest of the prison population does.
Is computer use completely out?
So actually, the Federal Bureau of Prisons has implemented email access for most of its prisons. Prisoners in the CMU do have some restricted email access. And in some ways, you know, I think that probably what that's about is making the sort of monitoring and analyzing job easier for counterterrorism unit officials, right? They'd rather read typed email than long handwritten letters. So, you know, in some ways, I think it's in their interest to allow prisoners to type at this point. But you know, it's not email the way we would normally think of email. A prisoner will type a message on a computer, and then 4 days later, after the counterterrorism unit has reviewed it and approved it and analyzed it, you know, the person on the outside in the outside gets the email. It's certainly not any sort of, you know, kind of instantaneous communication.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's delaying the communication between more for, like, their families and, you know, and for their own rehabilitation. This pretty much looks like it's just putting a retarding, and it's putting, like, just a pretty much empty space in what it is for what a jail should be for, like, for a prison should be for rehabilitation, for let every individual, right, that I, you know, it's pretty much let the other person look for the opportunity and discover for the opportunity to rehabilitate and to recognize that what the person did wrong and how he wants to contribute to society and how he wants to rehabilitate, which that should be pretty much like a free will choice mainly. But, you know, that free will can be exercised, I believe, with more contribution of others, not only prisoners' experience that go and talk to them. They should be probably having a little more access to things that can really help them and help their free will to say, you know what, it makes sense, you know, it has logic, it has reasons. And that's unfortunately the system that we are living right now is definitely not a rational based system.
Yeah, so. Thank you for that, Christian. I think it's really important what you're bringing up is that, you know, and there are in other countries special rehab programs for people who were designated as terrorists. I know that in Saudi Arabia they have one. Now, I can't say what these programs are like at all, but there are programs in some other countries for exactly that purpose that you were talking about. We do have another.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say that what's so frustrating is that, you know, prison officials understand that communication with one's family, with one's friends, is the most important thing to aid rehabilitation and to decrease recidivism, right? These individuals are all going to be released from prison eventually. If we want them to succeed in the outside world and to not reoffend, maintaining those community and family ties is key. And yet this is a program that flies in the face of all of that research and knowledge.
Yes, and the fact that it's experimental is of concern to me, too, in the sense that we know that Guantanamo has been used as an experiment with many parts, including what kinds of tortures will get people to say what kinds of things. But I do think that there's probably incredible monitoring going on from those units just to see if they can learn anything from changes in behavior, et cetera. We do have another caller, though. It's Jim. Jim, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, go ahead.
My question: How can federal prisons? This is more of a general question about imprisonment. How can federal prisons imprison? How can they lock up somebody, take away their First Amendment rights, but still have them count as a citizen for the places that they're incarcerated in? Because a lot of these prisoners, like you're saying, especially in the MCUs, they have a lot of their rights taken away, but the state can still count them as a resident, even though they can't vote, but they can still add them to the roster, even if they're not registered there. So it beefs up their ability to get more representation in the House. How does that work?
I don't know. Do you know, Rachel?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, I'm aware of that as an issue for census purposes, that prisoners are frequently counted, where they're incarcerated, especially when they've lost the right to vote. This can have really serious implications in terms of districting and the type of money that different districts are receiving. I think, it's all part of a larger picture of what the last caller was talking about, which is the way we as a society have moved away from seeing prisons as, intended to sort of incarcerate individuals when they are dangerous and then rehabilitate them so that they can, go on and to succeed in society. Instead, prison has become an industry, that makes money for states and for private corporations, and the individuals who happen to be warehoused in these institutions are really beside the point. They're used for political ends, for revenue generation, and their lives are largely seen as disposable.
Yes.
Yeah, see, that's my biggest thing, is it's like, if you're going to take away their rights, then you shouldn't be able to count them as any sort, it's like basically what you're looking at is they're counted as a source of income. They're basically treated more like cattle than they are people.
As an asset to the state in a funny kind of way.
Yeah, exactly. And that's my biggest problem, because it's like, how can you take away somebody's rights but then count them as a represented individual of your county when they, even if they're not registered there. So,
yep. Well, thank you, Jim. I appreciate that
yeah,
point
no
of view. I want to let people know the number again. It's 503-231-8187. Call with your questions and your comments about the communication management units. I would like to ask you, since I've got you here, Rachel, and you were the attorney, or still are an attorney, on the Pelican Bay solitary confinement case. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happened with that case? You did win that legally, right?
Yes. Well, we settled the case on extremely favorable terms. Exactly a year ago, we just had the one-year anniversary of settlement last week, in fact. And so for the last year, we've been monitoring the California Department of Corrections adherence to the requirements under the settlement. So basically, under the settlement, California agreed to review all of the prisoners who were held in solitary confinement based on allegations of gang membership. And so there was, a couple thousand prisoners who were to be reviewed under the settlement. California has made its way through most of those reviews at this point and has endorsed the vast majority, around 80% of the prisoners it has reviewed, for transfer to a general prison population setting. Most of those transfers have already occurred. So, we've heard from just over 1,000, thousands of prisoners who have been released from solitary confinement after 5, 10, 20 years.
Well, thank you. I just want to say thank you to the prisoners for their hard work, our hunger strikes and everything they did. But thank you as an attorney who brought that kind of change. It is difference making.
Thank you. I mean, it has just been an amazing case to work on for exactly the reason you brought up. You know, doing prison litigation, we have very little access to our clients frequently, and it's a population who operates under incredibly difficult conditions, right? The California case is amazing in that it was really, you know, it was begun by prisoners themselves who filed a pro se case. It was inspired by these hunger strikes that were incredibly successful in gaining public attention to the issue of solitary in California and really across the country. And the prisoners and the leadership of the hunger strikes were involved in the case, you know, in every piece of strategy in terms of moving the case forward. And it was their guidance and their direction and their sort of political acumen that got us to where we ended up and achieved this amazing settlement. So it has just been a absolutely inspirational case as an attorney to be able to take a part in.
Well, and it's so exciting to hear that, you know, so many of these have already been transferred. That's very heartening.
Yes, it is. And, you know, the stories that are coming out of solitary, men expressing what it's like to, you know, walk in the prison yard under the blue sky with other people around them and see, you know, a bug or a flower or a bird for the first time in decades is
to smell outdoor air makes me happy, you know, so I can imagine to get out there and just smell that outdoor air. It's like, you know, like a little doggy with our noses up in the air. But to me, that's one of the best things about walking outdoors in the morning, and to have that so completely restricted and now to have it back is tremendous. It's a really an important victory. You have a case that might be taken up by the Supreme Court. Would you like to talk about that? And I'll give our number one more time. If you'd like to call in and talk about the federal prison system or these communication management units, please call us at 503-231-8187. Let's talk about your other case, though. I'm trying to find my note here on the name of it.
Yeah, so Turkman v. Ashcroft
is
a case that we've been working on here at the Center for Constitutional Rights since 2002. So as listeners will remember, shortly after 9/11, there were roundups of Muslim, Arab, and South Asian men across the country, but really focusing in the New York and New Jersey area. And all these individuals were picked up in connection to the terrorism investigation, but really held under the authority of the immigration law. So the way it worked is that the FBI set up a hotline right after 9/11, and people were calling in, you know, with all sorts of tips, like my neighbor's Arab and he keeps strange hours. I think he might be a terrorist. And on that level of information, the FBI would go out with the INS and the NYPD or whatever police department they happened to be with at the time, and investigate the subject of the tip. And if they discovered that individual was here in violation of the immigration law, so maybe had overstayed his visa or was working unlawfully, he was held in connection to the terrorism investigation, even though there was never any reason besides his profile, right, his religion, his ethnicity, the fact that he was here unlawfully, to believe that he would have any connection to terrorism. And hundreds of men were profiled and arrested in this manner and then detained until they could be cleared by the FBI and the CIA of any connection to terrorism, and then they were deported. Many of them, while they were being detained in this way, were held in extremely restrictive conditions of confinement, basically in solitary confinement in a federal jail called the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York.
I've heard that that's a really, like, going back many, you know, 200 years look at prison, that there's rats and feces on the floor, toilets that overrun. Is that correct?
Well, so, you know, I don't know.
I mean, I'd heard about that particular.
As prior, as a couple hundred years ago. But, you know, it's really about, it's a solitary confinement unit. So you know, basically that means prisoners are locked in their cells 22 to 24 hours a day. They're only removed from their cells in handcuffs and shackles. It's sort of the modern-day equivalent of the hole, you know, totally about isolation and control and, you know, no access to the outside world. And they were abused, physically and verbally abused while they were held there. So guards, you know, beating them, calling them names constantly, keeping them from practicing their religion. And this was all, you know, based on a policy from the highest levels of government, you know, from then Attorney General Ashcroft himself, that, you know, individuals who fit this profile should be rounded up and detained so we could try to get any information they might have about terrorists, you know, whether or not they were involved in terrorism themselves. It was this idea that, you know, any Muslim living in this country unlawfully probably knew terrorists. Or
sounds like Trump, doesn't it? It sounds like one of our presidential candidates.
Yeah.
It does.
Well, it's very important. You know, that's why, that's one of the reasons that we're still litigating this case, you know, 15 years in, is that, you know, unless we hold high-level officials accountable for their discrimination and their abuse, it will happen again and again. And it is not enough to challenge something, you know, when it is going on and try to stop it. We have to actually seek out those individuals who allowed it to happen, who made it happen, and hold them individually accountable for their money to ensure that, you know, future leaders will not feel as though they can violate the constitutional rights of people in this country with impunity. And that is the issue that, that is potentially going to go up to the Supreme Court. We won a wonderful victory from the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, the federal appellate court here in New York last year, that we could move forward with our claims for individual damages from former Attorney General John Ashcroft, the former director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, and the former commissioner of the INS, James Ziegler. And those defendants have asked the Supreme Court to take the case. And we should learn this fall whether the Supreme Court will do so or not.
And that would be a very interesting case to watch, and very important how it was resolved, because if it said that this is appropriate way to treat people in an emergency or a crisis like that, then we're in trouble, aren't we?
Well, that's right. That's right. And, you know, really what at the heart of the case is the question of whether you can even sue high-level officials taken as a given when they are violating constitutional rights. So what the defendants are arguing is that it doesn't matter if we violated these individuals' rights, if we profiled them, if we abused them in prison, you know, without reason. You can't sue high-level government officials individually because that would, you know, deter people from wanting to, you know, hold
public office
high
or work
offices
in, yeah.
or, you know, work for the government, right? That they shouldn't be subject to that kind of federal court oversight. And if that happens, then that means these are individuals who are truly above the law, who can violate anyone's rights with complete impunity. That is a very terrifying proposition.
Yes, it is. Now, the plaintiffs in that case, were they all sent overseas? Were they all deported? So are your plaintiffs not here in the country?
They were. That's right. The group of men who were detained were all deported, and our clients currently are in Pakistan, in Egypt, in Nepal, in Canada. And the 9/11 detainees in general have now, you know, been sent all across the globe. And it's a difficult thing. You know, we just talked about the Pelican Bay case and the importance of sort of litigation on behalf of an organized community, right? And that is when I think we can see the best progress in the courts. It is incredibly difficult for individuals whose rights have been violated and then they've been sent overseas, you know, to ever sort of join together to fight, to defend themselves and their rights. And my clients who've been trying to do this sort of, you know, from all across the world for decades, you know, are really, you know, it's an incredibly difficult and incredibly draining type of battle to be in.
Yeah, especially as the years pass and life goes on, and we are all struggling with life in this world right now anyway, it being very difficult for most of us in the planet in one way or another. I really want to thank you for your call. I wanted to ask you one more question about these CMUs. Is this where you think Obama intended to transfer any Guantanamo detainees that he won't release?
You know, I have no idea if that's a possibility or not. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, certainly it does seem as though the units were set up initially really with an idea that they would be used for folks with some connection to international terrorism. So when the Bush administration first conceived of these units, I think they really were about, you know, people with some ties to international terrorism. But they were always talked about as sort of terrorism light, right? People like who you said who had material support convictions, not individuals who had engaged in sort of any kind of violent crime. The fact that there's so much nonviolent terrorism, you know, being punished in our prison system today is strange, but is really true. And so, you know, what's I think kind of terrifying about the units and important to understand is they can morph into anything the current administration wants them to be if there are no protections in place, right? And that's why due process is so important, is that, you know, we have to say, no, you cannot use this, you know, against whomever today you decide is a threat. You know, maybe it's Guantanamo detainees, maybe it's domestic terrorists, you know, maybe it's animal rights activists, who knows, right? But it cannot be that we have these sort of political prisons within political prisoners, you know, for any individual to be moved to without procedural protection or oversight.
Well, that is, I completely agree with you about the importance of that case. And this is Linda Olson-Osterlund for Political Perspectives. We've been talking with Rachel Maripolis, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. I have links to the Center for Constitutional Rights. It's ccr.org. You can go there and you can actually find the cases I love on your website. Your website was really easy to use. And with the cases, you can go directly to the actual briefs that you filed and read them to understand them better. So thank you so much for joining us this morning, Rachel Maripol.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on and for covering the issue in such depth. I appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And now we're going to go on to the rest of our morning here at KBOO. I want to thank Tammy, our engineer, and Kathleen Stevenson, our public affairs and AM news director.
Good morning. The time is 10 o'clock. That was Linda Olson-Osterlund speaking with Rachel Maripol. She's the attorney at the center and attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. And 10:15, stay tuned here for KABU for flashpoints. Today we look at Brazil, where there have been massive protests against what's being called a parliamentary coup, and the police have launched brutal attacks on protesters. At 11 o'clock, The Bike Show speaks with two local bike adventurists, Jasmine Reese and Spencer Harding. But coming right up, it's Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. Stay tuned for that, please. KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Clinton Street Stomp.